Apple and Google partner again? What are the Fed's tea leaves saying? How to activate semiconductor manufacturing in America? Japan's rare interest rate hike, and more. Welcome back to the Weekly Money Clip. In a market with millions of podcasts, it is tough to stay on top of the essential business and tech stories beyond headlines. This week, we will be counting down five key moments from last week to give you context for the week ahead. As always, clips are under 5 minutes, from voices you trust, adding context to headlines from the week behind to prepare you for the week ahead. Before we jump in, let's review the top headlines. This past week in the world of business, finance, and technology, the headlines have been buzzing with significant developments. From the gaming industry in Seattle, where a new studio is rising with fresh investments to forge ahead in creating immersive experiences, to the intriguing sphere of pet tech, where an app is revolutionizing how animal lovers connect. Meanwhile, the tech job market shows its volatile nature as layoffs continue, highlighting the challenges even experienced workers face in securing new roles. In the broader tech landscape, Microsoft made a strategic move by appointing a former Google executive to lead its AI efforts, signaling a deeper dive into the potential of artificial intelligence. On the legal and regulatory front, Apple finds itself under the scrutiny of the DOJ, adding to its pile of antitrust challenges, a scenario that underscores the tightening grip of regulation on big tech. Elsewhere, in a mix of finance and philanthropy, Mackenzie Scott's generosity shines through with a substantial grant distribution, underscoring the impactful role of philanthropy in addressing societal needs. And not to be overlooked, the financial markets have been a roller coaster, with major indices showing mixed signals amidst ongoing economic uncertainties. Finally, Reddit had a strong IPO on Thursday, but will their positive momentum continue? Investors hope this is an indicator of a prolific return of the IPO landscape. Those were the key headlines. Now let's dive into the stories behind the headlines. This week, we welcome Tom Hayes, Mitch Rochelle, Josh Hammer, Scott Stantis, and Jake Novak.
At number 5 in our countdown, we begin with Tom Hayes from Great Hill Capital in the groundbreaking deal between Google and Apple regarding AI. Google's AI services, particularly Gemini, will now be integrated into Apple's devices, solving Apple's long-standing AI quality issues, especially with Siri. The partnership reflects the existing relationship between the two tech giants, with Google already paying Apple billions annually to remain the default search provider. This move not only enhanced the value of both the phone and Google, but also positions Google as a leader in AI technology. This game-changing partnership has the potential to revolutionize the AI landscape, making the Apple phone indispensable and solidifying Google's dominance in search, query, and generative AI. Here's the full analysis from Tom.
Tom Hayes from Great Hill Capital wanted to get on and talk about the articles today regarding Google and Apple creating a deal where Google will provide their AI services, namely Gemini, to Apple's handsets. And this has solved an enormous problem for Apple. Their AI has been mediocre, to put it kindly, as it relates to Siri, has been a complete disaster. And so much so, I've even considered going to a Google phone just so when I ask my phone a question, I could get an answer quickly that would be useful. And that has certainly not been the case with Apple. I think this is a brilliant partnership. It mimics the relationship that they have in search. Google has been paying Apple billions of dollars a year to remain their default search provider for many years, and it's been a win-win relationship. Makes the phone more valuable, makes Google more valuable, and I think what's going to happen now is this could be a game changer because the vast majority of people will go with the default provider. And in this case, it's no longer going to be OpenAI or ChatGPT for AI queries. It is now going to be Google Gemini, and it's going to make the Apple phone and Moat indispensable, and it's going to accelerate Google's development and primacy in terms of their historic data, vast data pool, that they can then reinvest and become the leader in AI search, AI query, et cetera, to generative AI and beyond. So huge win-win for both parties. Today, as that plays out in coming days and weeks, I think it'll be constructive for both companies. And thanks for tuning in.
We now continue the countdown with number four. We join Mitch Rochelle for an in-depth analysis of the recent release of Federal Reserve Minutes. Mitch is a media commentator, macro strategist, podcaster, and public speaker on the economy, real estate, and policy. He can be seen regularly on Fox News, Fox Business, and News Nation. Despite investor excitement, Rochelle remains skeptical of the Fed's dovish stance due to potential political pressures, as seen with President Trump's past perceived attempts to influence policy. The current economic and political climate may lead the Fed to maintain its stance to avoid allegations of meddling with the election. With Fed Chair Powell's concern for his legacy, any allegations of interference could be detrimental. Any signs of the Fed not lowering rates could trigger negative market reactions, as seen in 2018. What else did Mitch have to say on the Fed's tea leaves? Here is the segment.
Mitch Rochelle with Money Clip here on Center Clip. Well, the Fed minutes came out, and when you read the tea leaves, known in Fed speak as dot plot, those are the interest rate aspirations of the various members of the Federal Reserve. And when they think they should, the Fed should lower rates, and by how much. So how much and when. And if you look at the consensus of the dot plots, it looks like as many as three rate cuts in 2024. These minutes came out on Wednesday, and as soon as they hit the tape, the stock market rallied, hit new highs, because one thing stock market investors love is lower interest rates. And the prospect that the Fed is going to ease monetary policy by lowering interest rates, that's good news for Wall Street. Is it good news for Main Street? That remains to be seen, because easing monetary policy could fuel more inflation. So we will wait and see. I, for one, do not think that the Fed will be as dovish, meaning lowering interest rates that much this year, because the second half of the calendar year, when they'll be doing it, we're sliding into the second half of the calendar year with spring upon us and only three quarters ahead, or three seasons ahead, I should say. It's very possible that the politics of the economy may be so acute that the Fed may find themselves politically pressured into doing nothing. Donald Trump famously sort of jawboned the Fed when he didn't like fiscal monetary policy, and the Fed ignored and dug in to their policy at the time. But it'll be interesting if the Biden administration jawbones the Fed a little bit. So there's a lot of wait and see there. And the path of least resistance to the Fed would be to do nothing in that political cycle, lest they be accused of interfering with the election by shining a bright light on an economic issue that surrounds interest rates. One comment I've made in the past on other platforms is Jerome Powell, chairman of the Fed, his undergraduate degree was in history. And as a student of history, I think he cares deeply about how he, as a Fed chair, will be remembered in history. And interfering with an election, potentially, or being accused of interfering in an election by one of the candidates, either one, is something that I don't think he wants on his historical resume. So I, for one, don't think we're going to get that easing from the Fed. And if I were to make a prediction, if the tea leaves from the Fed, whether they be dot plots or speeches made by Fed governors or board members, start indicating that they may be reversing course and not lowering rates, you can expect the stock market to send a signal. One last thing. It was October of 2018, and in a speech, Jerome Powell, in talking about interest rates, said we were far from neutral. Neutral interest rates, real quickly, is the rate at which it's neither hurting or helping the economy, sort of like slack tide if you are a boater. And the market didn't like that and precipitously sold off from that speech in October through the end of the year in 2018. The market doesn't like when the Fed is not cooperating. So we've got market forces, we've got political forces, and we've got an economy that still is far from perfect. Mitch Rochelle with a money clip on Center Clip.
The world's best-known investor and Wall Street expert, Warren Buffett, once said, "Wall Street is the only place that people ride to in a Rolls Royce to get advice from those who take the subway." Mr. Buffett's quote is remarkably accurate, but how many people would rather receive advice from him than someone simply guessing? Welcome to Buy, Hold, Sell, your single source for Wall Street knowledge and profitable guidance. Please join me, Todd Schoenberger, and fellow trader Tobin Smith, as well as host Veronica Dudo, for a podcast known to move the needle for investors. Tobin and I are seasoned Wall Street executives with deep investment experience, and we are prepared to share our advice to those who choose to listen. Download Buy, Hold, Sell today on the Evergreen Podcast Network or your favorite podcast channel.
Welcome back to number 3 in our weekly countdown with Back with Josh Hammer discussing a $95 billion grant given to Intel. Hammer is the Newsweek opinion editor, the Josh Hammer Show host, syndicated columnist, and Edmund Burke Foundation research fellow. In this audio op-ed, Josh discusses Intel, the top semiconductor company in California, receiving a hefty $8.5 billion grant from the U.S. government to bolster semiconductor production in the country. The CHIPS Act, signed into law by President Joe Biden, aims to bring semiconductor manufacturing back to the U.S. and counter China's dominance in the industry. Despite some shortcomings, the act is crucial for national security and supply chain resilience. With Taiwan's semiconductor manufacturing companies leading technologically, the U.S. must step up. The $8.5 billion investment in Intel is a positive outcome of the CHIPS Act, signaling a move away from laissez-faire policies towards a focus on national security. The U.S. desperately needs a comprehensive industrial policy for semiconductors. Here is the rest of the audio op-ed.
Intel, the leading semiconductor company and general California stalwart when it comes to contemporary technology, is now touting a massive $8.5 billion grant from the U.S. government in order to jumpstart U.S. semiconductor production. This is downstream of the CHIPS Act, the federal legislation that was being debated at times quite hotly in the United States Congress about a year and a half ago. Or so ago in the year 2022, was signed into law by President Joe Biden. Look, many folks on the right objected to the CHIPS Act, and it was not a perfect piece of legislation. I think in many ways it could have gone even further, especially as it pertains to cracking down on China, which is really what is going on in this bill when it comes to trying to reshore manufacturing for semiconductors, get some new foundries up and going there. I thought there could have been some slightly stronger intellectual property protections and things like that. But Fundamentally, to quibble like that is to miss the forest for the trees. America needs an industrial policy when it comes to semiconductors. In the year 2024, it is barely an exaggeration to say that semiconductors make the world go round. Your chip, your semiconductor, is used in everything from your iPhone or your computer to F-35 fighter jets. And it is a travesty. It should be nothing short of a 5-alarm fire and a wake-up call heard around the world that right now, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, has by far the largest market share of any foundry, any semiconductor manufacturer in the world. And furthermore, TSMC is actually creating chips, semiconductors, at a much more advanced level than American foundries are. Right now, TSMC has gone down chips to around 3 nanometers or so, which is really just remarkable. Intel hasn't as far as I'm aware, hasn't gotten any smaller or more concise than 7 nanometers. So technologically speaking, in holding volume aside, technologically speaking, just looking at that alone, America is seriously, seriously far below where many of our semiconductor rivals are around the world, very much including TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. And we have to get our act in order here. I mean, the idea of the neoliberal Washington consensus, let the chips fall where they may. There's that infamous line from the George H.W. Bush White House, computer chips, potato chips, what's the difference? What astounding hubris. What a total and complete failure to think in the mid to long term, to think about national security, to think about resiliency, to think about durability, to think about supply chains, to think about national security above all else. Fortunately, when it comes to things like the CHIPS Act, when it comes to things like this very bipartisan piece of legislation in the House to actually go ahead and force a divestiture of ByteDance to sell TikTok, these are the kind of moves that give me hope and optimism that the American political conversation is no longer solely focused on letting the chips fall where they may, so to speak, and is increasingly focused on core national security. So I, for one, look forward to hopefully seeing what comes from this $8.5 billion investment in Intel that, again, is downstream of the CHIPS Act, the law that passed a couple of years ago.
At number two this week, we address Japan's interest rate announcement with Scott Stantis. Scott is an internationally syndicated editorial cartoonist, senior fellow at the Alabama Policy Institute, and co-host of DMZ America podcast. Japan recently raised its interest rates for the first time since 2007, signaling the end of free money and a shift towards a stronger economy. On the other hand, the Federal Reserve in the United States is anticipated to maintain its current interest rates as inflation persists around 3.1 to 3.2%. Despite rising fuel prices, indicators such as employment rates and GDP continue to climb. Japan's decision to increase interest rates may lead to a short-term economic downturn, but in the long run, it will make borrowing more attractive and hold borrowers accountable. What else does this interest rate decision mean? Let's join Scott now.
Hi, I'm editorial cartoonist Scott Stantis coming to you for Money Clip. Well, Japan has raised its interest rates for the first time since George W. Bush was president. I'm not kidding. 2007, Japan has raised its interest rates above zero. It's about time. They've been suffering stagflation in Japan. The economy has not moved. And that's due in large part to the fact that money is free. So yeah, if you're borrowing money, awesome. If you're lending money, sucks to be you. Now, looking at interest rates here in the United States, the Federal Reserve Board will be meeting this week, and virtually everybody is betting that they won't budge on interest rates. And, you know, this is why am I obsessed with interest rates? I do a lot of postings here for that, because interest rates seem to be the most glaring example of where government meets free markets, and government planning usually fails free markets. I would much prefer a free floating, a more, I don't know, reactive interest rate. But in this case, the Federal Reserve is looking at a stubborn inflation rate of 3.1, 3.2%. Fuel prices are going back up, which of course will, no pun intended, fuel inflation. But employment continues to go up. GDP continues to grow. By the way, these are good things, Federal Reserve, just saying. Because as I've said before, it would be better to have slightly higher prices and a job than slightly lower prices and no job. But getting back to Japan, when you can have money and money begins to have value again, I suspect short term, Japan's going to have a bit of a, you know, a downturn because of the news that there's no longer free money. I suspect any economy, when they're told that there's no longer free money, people are going to be sad. But very quickly, it will recover. Interest rates will start to go back up there. That means banks and lenders will actually have rewards for lending money. People who are borrowing money will actually be responsible for it. It's a good thing. So, interest rates going up in Japan. Interest rates staying stagnant in the United States. Where this leads to, my suspicion is, in the American economy, we're going to see it leveling off. It was getting pretty hot. An interest rate cut would really drive it into the stratosphere. That's great short term. Long term, it's unsustainable. So if we can stay kind of in this great niche where we're growing the economy, but not at a white hot pace, that's a good thing. Looking to Japan, raising their interest rates slightly. And believe me when I tell you, it's very slight. But it also tells you that their economy is robust enough where the central bank feels secure in raising interest rates and actually making money have value. For MoneyClip, I'm Scott Stannis.
Ready to up your game and learn more about the thrilling world of sports betting? Introducing Double Down with Breslow, the ultimate podcast about the business of sports gambling. Join me, James Breslow, and a long list of expert guests as we dive into the art and science of the sports betting industry. Evolving regulations, technology enhancements, and the meteoric rise in the number of players makes this sector the fastest growing and most intriguing in the world. Unlock the business secrets from many of the industry's most recognizable C-suite executives, including famous odds makers and influencers. Every episode of Double Down with Breslow is packed with insider tips, deeply skilled analysis, and in-depth discussions. Don't miss out on the ultimate resource for mastering the business of sports betting. Listen to Double Down with Breslow on the Evergreen Podcast Network or wherever you listen to podcasts. That's Double Down with Breslow, the business of sports betting podcast.
To round out our countdown this week, we have Jake Novak to discuss the United States antitrust lawsuit against Apple. Novak is a political analyst and commentator. The Department of Justice filed an antitrust lawsuit against Apple, causing a sharp 4% drop in their shares. Despite this, historical evidence shows that companies targeted in such cases often emerge stronger. Just look at Microsoft in 1998. Initially thought to be doomed, they adapted, collaborated with the government, and thrived. Apple, under CEO Tim Cook, is likely to do the same. Investing in Apple stocks during this dip could prove to be a strategic move, as past cases reveal that these situations lead to stronger partnerships and profitability. Let's hear the rest of Jake's opinion on the Apple downturn.
Hi, I'm Jake Novak, and buying opportunity alert, the Department of Justice is suing Apple in a landmark antitrust case. Apple shares are down 4%, and this seems like real bad news for Apple. Don't want to touch Apple, right? Well, wrong. Because if you take a look at the history of major antitrust efforts, especially against big tech in this country, it has almost always led to the company being targeted, becoming even more powerful and even more profitable in not even the very long run. I would say the medium run. And I think that's what's going to happen here with Apple, because you need to understand the motivations behind some of these antitrust suits. It's not so much to destroy the company, or in this case, to destroy the goose that lays the golden egg that is Apple, but it's to get it into more partnership with the government. And when I say the government, I don't mean politicians or elected leaders, but the regulatory bureaucracy. Now, I've got a good case study to prove this, and I think it's very important we all look at this more closely. When the Clinton administration, the bureaucracy, the Justice Department, and the Clinton administration slapped Microsoft with its antitrust action back in 1998. A lot of people thought this was going to be the end of Microsoft as we know it. It was going to be split up into many parts. There was all kinds of epitaphs being written for Microsoft. What really ended up being the result of that antitrust action was that Microsoft adjusted itself to be a much did become a different company, but it became a more profitable company. Microsoft, as far as market cap right now, is ginormous. It's done very, very well. The company that it was in 1998 bears very little resemblance to what it is now, and that is a lot because of how it adjusted, how it worked with the government, how it worked with the bureaucracy after it was hit with that antitrust case. Now, I don't know if Apple is going to change all that much the way that Microsoft did as a result of this case. But I do know that Apple's not stupid. And Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple's not stupid. And they will do what they need to do to work with the Justice Department to make this case, I wouldn't say go away, but work with it in a way that will make everybody happy in the end. including investors. If I were you, I would buy more Apple shares today, especially if they go down again in the next couple of days with the belief that this antitrust action is going to somehow shrink Apple's business. It won't. History tells us it won't. And the government, in particular, isn't really interested in that. The government just wants a bigger piece of the action or other kinds of benefits that it can get from reminding companies like Apple, because this isn't just about Apple, it's about all big tech. Government has realized that there's a lot it can get from partnering with big tech and getting it on its team. That's what these things are all about. I'm Jake Novak. Thanks for listening.
We'll have to hold it there. Please remember this episode presents the personal opinions of these individuals and should not be viewed as investment advice. Thank you to Tom Hayes, Mitch Rochelle, Josh Hammer, Scott Stantis, and Jake Novak. For their work and more in real time, please visit centerclip.com. This show has been produced in collaboration with Crosscheck Media Management. Crosscheck redefines family office services with a distinctive blend of financial expertise, media innovation, and alternative investments. One topic at a time, leaders on both sides, always under 5 minutes. That is elevating discourse. Again, centerclip.com for more throughout the week. We'll be back next week. This has been the Weekly Money Clip.
On any given day in Washington, policy proposals are created, debated, and decimated by tens of thousands of people and organizations working behind the scenes. On 80 Proof Politics, a guest and I will visit a D.C. watering hole and distill the art of advocacy by pulling back the curtain a bit and taking a look at how they play their part in the sausage factory we call our federal government. So if you're at all interested in how the sausage is made, pull up a chair, grab a drink, and join us. After all, what goes better with sausage than a tall, cold one?